Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you think American cuisine is just hamburgers and apple pie, you can think again. Every corner of the nation embraces its own distinct culinary traditions and inventions. From Maine lobster rolls to Nashville hot chicken, Louisiana po' boys to Cincinnati chili, and let's not forget Korean pancakes. We're talking about the food cultures and diverse recipes that have evolved to make up the American diet. Joining us by phone is author and former editor of Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn magazines, Gabrielle Langholz. Her new book is entitled America, the Cookbook. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The Cookbook was an ambitious project. It's also a super fat cookbook, which I always love. How did it come about?
I got super fat myself while working on it, to be honest. Luckily, I can just do weightlifting with it.
Exactly.
How it came about. So I had I'd been a magazine editor in New York for 10 years, and I had done a cookbook about cooking from the farmer's market called the New Green Market Cookbook. And I had lunch with an editor at the publisher Fiden, and a couple months later, when I left, I thought, I don't know if we'll ever do anything together. I couldn't tell. And a couple months later, I got a little email from her saying, we want to do a great big project called America, the Cookbook. Are you interested? And my life has not been the same since, to be honest. So Fiden has done a bunch of international, what they call culinary Bibles. They did India, the Cookbook. Actually, first they did the Silver Spoon. They bought the international rights to the Silver Spoon, which is sort of the joy of cooking of Italy, and that performed very well for them. And they've done Mexico, the Cookbook, the Nordic Cookbook, Peru, the Cookbook. And I was fortunate to get to work on America, the Cookbook.
You had your own journey before this, from childhood to adulthood, traveling the nation with your, I guess, wanderlust family. But You wrote in the introduction that your parents were not foodies, so it wasn't about that.
Right. Yeah. Emily came to me because she knew me professionally, and I jumped at the opportunity, but she didn't yet know that I had actually already been to all 50 states. And as a kid, I was in this crazy, wonderful family that moved around a lot. I was born in Indiana. We lived in Kentucky. My parents are from New York, lived in Kentucky, California, 6 years in Alaska, 6 years in Oklahoma, Colorado, New York City, Virginia, and I now live in Pennsylvania. I'm married to a farmer. And along the way, my mom was a cultural anthropologist. My dad eventually worked at the UN. And they were not foodies. At home, we had peanut butter sandwiches and spaghetti and sauce out of a jar. And but my parents just loved to go experience stuff. And, in Oklahoma, that meant powwows. I mean, my mom was, as I said, a cultural anthropologist mm-hmm. and working on her dissertation, so that was some research. But, stockyards and ice fishing. And, I mean, when I lived in Alaska, we literally tried whale blubber one time, which you can get there from the tribes. And fry bread, and we kind of sucked the marrow out of the American experience, so to speak, as a way to, when in Rome, experience things and get off the highway and get into the back roads and get out of the chains and get into the independent businesses and really experience a place. And food is such an avenue into that.
We're talking about American cuisine. My guest is Gabrielle Langholz. She's author and former editor of Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn magazines. Her new book is entitled America, the Cookbook. Like I said, it's a doorstopper. It's big, but it kind of had to be that way, right?
It's funny. It's about 850 recipes, and in the end, I feel like it's barely the tip of the iceberg.
Exactly.
I had 3 years to work on it on top of 40 years of eating my way across the country. And, I should have had 50 years or 500 years to really do it right.
Yeah, as I was reading through it, of course, and paging through it, I never got tired of reading about all the stories you have. There's 50 states, there's 50 stories. And one of the things you did was choose guest essayists.
Exactly.
Some were chefs, some not. All of them, have a big toehold in the food world, though.
That was my editor's vision, exactly. So the first 600 recipes in the book are I worked on with a team of recipe developers and recipe testers across the country, from upstate New York to Birmingham, Alabama, and Texas and Seattle, and a bunch of folks in between. And for those, as I say, the first 600 recipes in the book, those are really the kind of straight, quote-unquote, traditional, the way your mom or grandma would have made these meatloaf and, you know, mashed potatoes and a lot of other things, too. But in the back of the book, the last 200 recipes, and as you said, we have 50 essays. So for each state, we invited a chef to contribute a little mini menu for the state. And those are usually a little bit more of a chef-y riff, a little bit more elevated, still the kind of thing that the home cook should be able to make without any, you know, professional training or equipment or ingredients. But and also, as you said, we have an essay from each state, usually a chef, sometimes a food writer, or, you know, we have Alice Waters and Jonathan Gold for California, mm-hmm. Norman Van Aken for Florida. Danny Meyer did Missouri, Anita Lowe did Michigan, just a really incredible group of people. Adam Sachs did Kentucky, Adam Gopnik from The New Yorker did New York. So a lot of just beautiful perspectives that people shared on the foods of their home state. And I'll tell you, a really interesting thread ran through many of them that mm-hmm. really opened my eyes. I mean, many people wrote a real love letter to their state, and, you know, P. Allen Smith down in Arkansas, I loved his piece about growing up in just this beautiful Arkansas childhood. And, you know, I have to admit, I wasn't sure what I was going to find in Arkansas. And I, after a day there with him, I was like ready to move there and never leave. But, you know, many people wrote just waxing rhapsodic about the field peas and the quail hunting and just, this, you know, spectacular culinary experiences of their childhood. But I also had many essayists who wrote about growing up and wanting to leave. I mean, literally, you know, the essays are sorted alphabetically. So Alabama is the first. And the first mm-hmm. sentence of the first essay says, "When I left Alabama, I was never going back." That's by Scott Peacock. Yeah. And many people talk about feeling this way and growing up and saying, you know, I want to be a chef. I want to be a culinary professional. I'm getting out of here. And people really, certainly in my childhood, and I think even in beforehand over the past century, people in America, I think, really looked to Europe, really didn't see value in American cuisine, French technique, French culinary training. You know, you looked at the cover of Gourmet magazine, you know, eventually became Italy, Japan, but really not valuing the foods of America. And I think that's really starting to change, or has changed just in the past decade, past yeah. 2 years. I'm sure you see that too. That,
oh, yeah, yeah. It's changing very, yep. very quickly. Mm-hmm. Just in Columbus, we've lived here for 30 years, and it's kind of shocking how much it's changed. It is a Columbus person who wrote the essay for this to representing Ohio, Jenny Britton Bauer of Jenny Splendid
her.
Ice Creams. Yeah.
Yes.
Fantastic.
I am crazy about Jenny Britton Bauer. I met her, gosh, probably 15 years ago. Alice Waters actually brought her to New York City. And I got to, I mean, I was just blown away by getting to meet her, and yeah. just enormous respect for what she does, what she's done for Ohio. And that kind of approach of saying, this is the place that I'm from. This is my place. There is place-based taste here. I'm going to cook these flavors. I'm going to cook these stories. I'm going to buy from these farmers and sing it loud. And I think she's just a quintessential example of that kind of pride of place that we're now seeing in every state.
She called Ohio a crossroad of at least three distinct food and cultural
yes.
reasons, the Midwest,
mm-hmm.
the Northeast, and the South. And I was wondering, mm-hmm. was that a theme that popped out in other states?
That theme of being at a crossroads?
Yeah, I wasn't able to read all of the essays.
Sure.
I know Louisiana had different pieces
yes.
to it, for example.
Multicultural,
very
much.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what we wanted each essayist to do, and they took many different vantage points and, mm-hmm. and approaches, but to say, what is the identity of the cult? It's interesting because ultimately this book says, what is American food? But that's really a way of saying, what is America? So mm-hmm. to say, you know, what is Ohio cuisine, it's kind of saying, who are we? What is this place? Because our food is really just a manifestation and reflection of our history, our citizenry, our culture, and our values. So and the geographic place and what grows wild there.
Talk about cultural anthropology.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, just an incredibly fun and rich project. And honestly, like I said, 850 recipes. I feel like I barely scratched the surface.
And she talked about the influence of she didn't brag about her fabulous ice cream.
I don't know why not.
Yeah, she focused on the inspiration of Ohio's public markets and mm-hmm. said that if you want to know something about Ohio, especially what we eat, start at our public markets.
Mm-hmm. I think the way, on the one hand, Ohio is right there in the heartland and spectacular farming and harvests and dairy, but also looking at the people who have moved there. And she talks about at the market being inspired by everything from Italian prepared foods and I think she says cracklins and mm-hmm. wine and Palestinian food and the many ingredients and the spice cabinet that sits there at that crossroads. All of which makes its way into her spectacular ice cream, which, by the way, is my favorite thing to send as a gift. Anytime, you know, every wedding, every new baby, I'm like, here's $110 worth of a box of magic from Jenny's. Make sure you're home to receive it.
Exactly. You made an incredibly good point, I thought, in your introduction, that just as the so-called New World was a revelation to the likes of Christopher Columbus and his ilk, never mind that people already were living there, yep. America food 500 years later has been discovered.
Exactly, yeah. And obviously it's so charged now, Columbus Day, and to think about what it means to quote-unquote discover something that's been there all along and
right.
that many people call home. But I do see a parallel there with American food. And I got assigned this book and turned it in a year ago, so before the election. But I think there is this sort of question of the quote-unquote coastal elite, which maybe some people would say I am, and whose opinions matter. And in all of my readings and interviews and research, you know, I found so many people saying, oh, now country ham from Tennessee and Kentucky and Virginia are on the menu in this restaurant in New York. You know, now it matters. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of question, okay, so the most famous, most expensive chefs in America have quote-unquote discovered the foods from sea to shining sea. But of course, everyday people have been enjoying these foods for generations, and they were there all along, even if people in the cities were cooking French food and serving it on white tablecloths.
You know,
a kind of attention and value being paid now. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. Another thing that struck me is a lot of the guest recipe
contributors,
because the recipes weren't always contributed by the essayist.
Correct.
They were they're chefs in big cities, but they're from the rest of the country.
In many instances, yes. So people saying, you know, I'm in New York now, but the flavors that I grew up with in Maryland or Kentucky. I mean, in many places, you know, for Kentucky, we have Ed Lee, who grew up either way around, grew up mm-hmm. in Brooklyn and is cooking in Kentucky now and doing incredible things with the food game there. And it's a big mixed-up melting pot. And I think that is one of the real strengths of American cuisine and American culture.
We'll continue
our just stay in silos.
Exactly. We'll continue our conversation about American food with Gabrielle Langholtz. She's author and former editor of Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn magazines. Her new book is entitled America, the Cookbook. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you this hour. Tell us what you think the quintessential American food is from where you sit at your table. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what screams America on the table at night? We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about American food. What does it mean to you? What's the quintessential American dish? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. My guest is author and former editor of Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn magazines. Her new book is entitled America, the Cookbook. Gabrielle Langholtz, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How do you even plan a book like this? As we mentioned earlier, it's a doorstopper. It's big.
Yes, it's a monster. Well, originally when I got the assignment, we had talked about my goal was 500 recipes. And, of course, I was unable to stay down in that number and almost went to twice it. But originally, it was just so much fun to sit down and start lists. And thinking about the quintessential iconic dishes of every region and every state. And, it's just trying to look, obviously we've got roast chicken and fried chicken and mashed potatoes and collard greens and peach pie and strawberry shortcake, all those icons, mm-hmm. and they're in the book. But it was so much fun to find real regional specialties like elk and wild, abalone and rabbit.
Pasties from Michigan, yeah.
Yeah, and things like saltwater taffy in New mm-hmm. Jersey and whoopie pies and, crawfish, pierogi, pickled pike. So much fun with the wild foods like pawpaw ice cream and cactus pad salad and chili rellenos down south and mutton stew and up in the upper Idaho and Pacific Northwest, trout and huckleberry pie and blackberry buckle. I mean, it was just so much fun. So in answer to your question, in terms of organization of the book, a lot of spreadsheets, mm-hmm. Believe it or not, I actually had a Harvard-trained researcher who was my right hand, and a lot of books. I ordered, 100 or 200 books on mostly on eBay, really regional and many out of print books. And I had been to every state before I got the assignment, and then I revisited, 22 states in the 3 years that I was working on the book. And, I wish I had a couple more decades. I asked my editor for an extension at one point, and, I think I wanted a lifetime extension to, really go out there and wallow in American food.
Melanie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
Hey, Melanie.
Good. Hi. So what foods, especially with Thanksgiving coming up, that I find to be quintessentially Midwestern, I think, is the green bean casserole.
Mm-hmm.
One that even as our food tastes have grown and changed to be fresh foods and locally sourced things, I still want it to be green beans out of a can and that sort of a condensed slob out of a can. I don't want anything fresh about that one. I just love it the way it is.
Just nice and mushy and fattening, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I know what you mean. I love, I think that a good green bean from the garden is probably my single favorite vegetable, especially when it's right on the cusp between a green bean and a shell bean.
Huh.
Like when the within the little beans are plumping up, but the pod itself is still tender enough to be eaten as a vegetable, you know, kind of right around September 1st, depending on when you planted it.
Yeah.
And yet I love a canned bean at the diner, even, you know, they're mushy and they're gray. And sometimes nothing else will do. And that green bean casserole at Thanksgiving, don't get between me and that dish. And there's something about the foods that we grew up with. And, you know, if we tasted it for the first time as an adult, I think it wouldn't have that kind of Proustian, you know,
yeah,
meaning. But the foods of our childhood, I read a quote somewhere that patriotism, it all comes down to loving the foods you ate as a child.
You know, there's something that I ate as a child that I loved. It was Dutch rusk toast in the round packages, right? And they'd put,
I don't know this.
Yeah, we put warm milk over it and butter and sugar.
Ooh.
And it's so like Western Michigan. It's not even funny now that I look back on it, but I can't find the Dutch rusk anymore. I don't know if they make it, but
stupid.
I would never eat it now, but every once in a while I really want it. So.
I know what you mean. There are foods that when I'm eating them, I'm like, okay, this is good. But when I can't get it, it's incredible craving. And I think there are so many foods that, you know, I mentioned having one bite of whale blubber as a child, and, you know, I couldn't even have one bite. But for people for whom that is their childhood food, for whom that is their traditional food, I mean, whale obviously is complicated for a lot of reasons, but, you know, I was at a festival in North Carolina, and I ate chitlins for the first time in my life, and they're not a traditional food for me. I hadn't grown up with them. I was glad to taste them. I had them with vinegar and hot sauce. And I mentioned I'm married to a livestock farmer, so I'm very familiar with pigs, and I'm around pigs a lot, and I eat a lot of pig. And to me, I was like, this is a strong pig smell that is not a food. but for people for whom that's the food that they grew up on, you know, there's nothing else like it. There'll be a hole in your heart without it. And I'll also say, as an adult, love falling in love with foods that are new to me. But there's nothing like the foods you grew up on.
I didn't read every essay, as I said, but one that I really, really loved was one that I really loved was the guy, and I can't remember who it was, but who wrote about smoked chub.
Yes, Paul Kahan in Chicago.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Tell us about that story.
So he's one of the most respected chefs in the country and in the world, and I was thrilled when he said he would contribute an essay, and I had a great time interviewing him on the phone. That was just an honor. And again, European technique, white tablecloth, tasting menu. He's been to, you know, every Michelin restaurant in France, and he said nothing will ever match this one mouthful of food that I had as a child. So he grew up in Chicago. His dad ran a smokehouse, smoking fish from Lake Michigan. And he had this memory. He was like one of the younger brothers. Maybe he's 9, and, you know, his older brothers already got to help out. And finally, he got his chance to ride in the van to go pick up the chub from the boats that are catching it on the Great Lakes. And I remember he said that the van was driven by an ex-con, that, you know, his dad was always going out of his way to employ folk, good people who had just, you know, needed to get way to get back on track. And he describes all in this very unglamorous, like, very early morning van, freezing fingers, loading the fish, unloading the fish, pushing it into the smoke room. And then his dad sticking a bagel in the toaster there in his office and pulling a piece of the still hot smoked fish right off of the bone and shoving it right in his mouth. And he says, you know, just nothing in all of my fabulous years as a chef since has ever matched that moment. And he says, I know it was because my dad and my brother and my family and growing up, but he said his chefs in his restaurants still tease him that they're like, what, everything needs cream cheese added to it, or you know, nothing's as good as that bagel out of the office toaster.
That sounds so good. And by the way, Melanie, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. Yeah, the chub. And what's sad is the alewives pretty much drove most of the chub out of Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I can. It came up when I was a little girl. That's when the alewives were, littering the beaches, and it was a big, huge mess. But
wow.
Just the idea of having hot smoked fish, just the thought of that. Peg in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Peg.
Having grown up in southern Iowa, I wondered if she has encountered two things that I remember. One is breaded pork tenderloin sandwiches, which I think are an adaptation of Wiener Schnitzel, but I didn't know about Wiener Schnitzel then. And
right.
The other were there were two friends of my mother's who competed on who made the better crescent rolls.
Mm-hmm.
They were
which
shaped.
Looks like a croissant rolled up.
Yeah,
like
they look like
triangle.
A croissant, but I think
uh-huh.
they're not. They're yeast roll, but they're
yeah.
wonderful. But I've never mm-hmm. encountered anybody else who knows how to make them.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I think they were substituted with the Pillsbury version you could get in the supermarket.
Right. A bastardization, if ever there was one. Yeah.
Yes. Do you want to tell a little bit about the breaded pork cutlet?
Well, we finally found a couple of places in Columbus. They're mostly Iowa, Illinois, Indiana. But there's a place out by the soccer stadium that has them, and they do them right. They're pounded pork and then breaded, and it's, you know, the patty plays out over the bun. It's, I'm not sure any, well, yeah, my husband likes them.
How do you cook them? Do you fry them or what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Are they called an Iowa skinny?
Frisch's, that's where they have them out by the soccer stadium.
What's that, Gabrielle?
Are they called an Iowa skinny? It's like a pork cutlet sandwich. I believe that recipe actually appears, are you ready for this, on the cover of the, there's a great book out from Cook's Country. They have a book called Cook's Country Eats Local. And I believe the sandwich that you're describing actually made it on the cover, and it's representing Iowa.
Well, it certainly is deserving of it.
Excellent.
I cannot tell you how many places we looked when we moved here to finally find some place that had.
Hey, Peg, do you know the name of that restaurant you're talking about?
Frisch's.
Frisch's?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Which is okay, Frisch's out of Cincinnati. What do you know? Okay. Peg,
yeah.
Thanks for the call.
I was just going to say a source that I love for finding places like that, which you may already know, is Road Food. If you know the Road Food books by Jane and Michael Stern,
mm-hmm.
Who are just, I believe they deserve like a Congressional Medal of
Honor.
I've
heard interviews with them. Yeah.
Oh, they're incredible. Their books are incredible. I think they're in their 11th edition, and I keep buying new ones. And their website has a lot of information, too, roadfood.com. But they really shine a light on non-chain, regional specialties, side of the road. And they will point – you know, whenever I have a big road trip, I first look, where did Jane and Michael Stern tell me to go? And they will point me to things just like that pork cutlet sandwich.
Peg, thanks for that call. Again, anyone else has their idea about what the great American food is on their table, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out the All Sides Facebook page and post your comment there. Corn played a starring role in the Ohio mm-hmm. recipes for Michael Anthony. He's an Ohio native who's who's executive chef of Gramercy Tavern and Untitled in New York.
Yes, and he was named a few years ago best chef in the country.
Yeah.
And so thrilled to get his participation. And I think he also deserves, like, the award for nicest person in the country. And he's a very proud Ohio native, and I've met his parents, too. And Corn, of course, you know, I kind of wanted Corn to be on the cover of the book. I mean, what could be more American?
But they didn't do
course,
anything, yeah.
The cover? Oh, well, the cover is this beautiful red, white, and blue plate. I'm maybe a little bit too literal, and the designers work their magic. But corn, of course, was a staple of American cuisine before it was called America. Mm-hmm. You know, 1491. So, and it was so interesting. I loved learning about the Native American foods that were here and are still here. And one of my contributors, I have three Native American contributors in the book, including Winona LaDuke. And I worked with Freddie Bitsoy, who is from the Four Corners area and is now the executive chef at the Smithsonian in D.C. They have the National Museum of the American Indian, and NAI. And their museum cafe, I've been to a lot of museum cafes in my life, is just the most interesting, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I love going through the whole museum, but I think it's worth going literally just to the cafe because you learn so much about Native American or American Indian First People. There are so many phrases now. Mm-hmm. And it's divided by region, and it is an exhibit in itself. And you see the wild foods of the Pacific Northwest and the Southwest and the Northern Woodlands and many of those foods we still know today. Mm-hmm. He's got cedar planked Alaskan salmon, and in the Southwest, the pumpkins, the chilies, the corn. Up in the Great Lakes region, the wild rice and wild mushrooms and cranberry. And many of those foods, it was such a pleasure to learn more about them. And some of them I already had known, and many were new to me. And many of those we included in the book. And speaking of what's native to America and what's brought by immigrants, one of the themes that kind of emerged for me while doing my research is how we think about quote unquote immigrant food or ethnic food, or at least I did, or I think many people do. We think about like, oh, let's go out tonight for Filipino food or Japanese food or Peruvian food. You know, let's go out for ethnic food. But so many, nearly all of the dishes that we think of as quintessential Americana were brought here by immigrants. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even looking back, like pork, chicken, beef, you know, brought here by the Spanish. I mean, when you think of roast chicken or you think of barbecued pork or you think of a steak, you literally think of a hamburger and a hot dog. I think of these as just sort of the spokesmodels of American food. And of course they're brought by German immigrants. They're brought from Hamburg and Frankfurt, and German immigrants of course brought beer to the United States. And, you know, we like I said, we had corn and beans and squash and tomatoes and chili peppers. And I also, in the book, I have bison and antelope and salmon, but, so many of the foods that we think of, it's just sacrosanct American menu, were brought here. And even things like spaghetti and meatballs and pizza and lasagna, I mean, as recently as literally, you know, 100 years ago, it sounds like a long time ago. It's not the early 1900s. Nobody in America was eating those foods. Mm-hmm. You know, Giotto was not a famous person, and nobody's watching Lydia Bastianich and creating those recipes and revering those cuisines. So those foods that we think of as immigrant foods today are just the most recent in a long line.
A quick email from Carl asked, did you look at Martha Washington's cookbook in your research?
Yes. There's a woman named Karen Hess who passed away recently, but had done a lot of work with Revolutionary era, like the most early cookbooks. I was going to say Virginia cookbooks. There's the Virginia Housewife, a lot of stuff from Monticello, actually, Thomas Jefferson's home. Just really incredible gardens there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he made macaroni and cheese at the White House that he had tasted in Europe, and all his different kinds of peas, and even tried making olive oil at Monticello. So the book, my editor very much wanted it to be foods that are made today. You know, we don't have syllabub and we don't have colonial foods in the book unless they're still eaten. But I loved looking back at those very early American cookbooks as inspiration.
We're talking about quintessential American food today, what it means in today. My guest is Gabrielle Langholz. She is an author and former editor of Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn magazines. Her new book is called America, the Cookbook. Give us a call and share what you think the quintessential American food is on your table. 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about what makes quintessential American food quintessential American food. My guest is Gabrielle Langholz. She has a new book out. It's called America, the Cookbook. It covers recipes from all 50 states. There's essays from all 50 states. There are guest recipes or recipes from guest chefs from all 50 states. If you have an idea for what you think is the quintessential American food, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Gabrielle, how did you go about whittling it down? How would you make the cut?
It was hard. We tried to really... look at that's why we went over by 350 recipes.
Yeah, right.
And ended up with
didn't whittle it down.
Right. Whittling it down is not my strong suit. Yeah. So I'm like, let's go big. Yeah, my editor had to cut me off. but we tried to look at foods that really represent a place. You know, I think I used the phrase place-based taste, and you know, it's something that's evolving and changing every day. And, you know, some people, I think of the phrase American cuisine as an oxymoron or a punchline. And American food has become famous around the world for making people sick, making people overweight, and it's food that is often bought through a car window, or is just add water, you know, very packaged, processed, and you know, in ways we earned that reputation. And the bad news about American food is certainly real, but I'm here to say the good news about American food is also very real and growing. So we have long and deep food traditions in this country that we should be proud of, and are not typical of the kinds of standard American diet I was just describing, which was kind of a 20th century invention. And so in addition to having deep roots, we also have a real renaissance of great food happening in America today. And I think part of that was sparked by the farmers market movement. I think part of it was people looking at the standard American diet and processed food and saying, hey, you know, we're losing something here and we can do better. And there are wonderful, wonderful foods to find and buy and feast on and get, connect with, and they're meaningful. We were I was kidding a little bit earlier when I was talking about Proust, and you know, he has the, I haven't read those books, but he talks about, I think it's called Remembrance of Things Past, and yeah, you know, he has a bite of, I think it's a Madeleine, and it triggers all these memories. And I saw this great New Yorker cartoon where it's got Proust biting into a Madeleine out of a package, and it says, like, fat-free and, you know, all these claims on it. And there's the big thought bubble above his head, and it's blank. like, this means nothing. This doesn't have any significance or meaning or feelings or associations. So I think we noticed what we were missing. And now with the farmers market movement, the locavore movement, rediscovering quality, craft beer, craft American cheese. You know, American cheese doesn't have to mean an orange product that comes out of a factory and is perfectly wrapped in plastic. There's spectacular American cheese, farmstead and otherwise, and in Ohio and across the country. And not all of that is rediscovery. Some of it is brand new. So many of the flavors and recipes stand on tradition, and many of them are also invention. I mean, goat cheese is one example. Goat cheese was unknown, really unknown in the United States in, I think, 1971 when Laura Chanel opened a goat dairy in California and Alice Waters put it on the menu. It was just not a thing in the United States. And Coach Farm Dairy in upstate New York opened around the same year. And now goat cheese is literally in, you know, it's Applebee's, it's the Cheesecake Factory, it's in every supermarket, everywhere. So that's just one example. I love goat cheese, and I love goat cheesecake. And we're, I think, the bad news is real, and I have to acknowledge that, but there's so much real progress, quality, improvisation, and innovation happening, too.
Zach in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Zach.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Great, how are you, Zach?
I'm really good. Sorry, I'm just nervous talking on the radio.
Oh,
same.
But,
I guess while listening to the rest of the conversation since I originally called in, I realized that I think one of the most American foods, at least that we have here in Ohio, is geta. I don't know if this was discussed on air. Do you guys know what geta is?
No, I don't know what it is.
It's got oatmeal in it. Is that right?
Pinhead oats.
Yes.
And so historically, head meat from a hog left
sausage
after butchering.
Yeehaw.
And,
yes.
You know, entrails, et cetera. Mm. But it turns out to be a lot like scrapple in New England.
Yes, and in Pennsylvania, yes.
So geta is big in Cincinnati. There's, you can get Glyer's geta in the grocery store through the Kroger grocery chain because it's also from Cincinnati. But you go north of Cincinnati, which was Porkopolis back in its heyday, you can find geta, but in a totally different form in that it's exactly the same thing, except no one calls it geta. They call it grits.
Oh.
They call it grits.
Absolutely. This is something that I have not been able to learn anything about from anybody other than I've just noticed this myself. So if you move to Cincinnati as a German immigrant in the 1870s, 1880s, you're speaking High German or Low German, Hochdeutsch or, you know, or other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people that lived in Cincinnati spoke High German, which this geta was how you pronounce the food that they made. And if you go north about an hour or two in places like Shelby County, Mercer County, Auglaize County, Ohio, you can go to a grocery store and find grits, which is exactly like geta, homemade right there at the local IGA, but it's called grits.
And it's called grits even though it has pork in it, right?
I
think of grits.
Like, it's the exact same recipe as geta.
Oh, wow.
It's just that it's called grits because the people that lived in that area did not speak High German, but they spoke Low German.
Interesting.
Interesting.
So anyhow, I think that that's sort of a, I wouldn't say the most American food, but one of many great American foods because it's not something you find in Germany either. I have very German heritage, as most people in Western Ohio do, but it's not something you find in Germany. It's something you find in Western Ohio.
Hmm.
It's an American invention.
Yeah,
absolutely. Leftover from, I mean, I worked on a dairy farm about 3 years ago in Fort Laramie, Ohio, in Shelby County, and my farmer, Leroy Meyer, he would have a hog every year. That's all he did. He didn't even have pigs other than this one pig, and every year he would butcher his pig, and he would make geta, which he called grits, and he put it in the freezer. But
excellent. Well, I read about it. I know how it's, I remember it's spelled G-O-E-T-T-A. Is that correct?
Yes.
I came across it and it's, I know it's served for breakfast and sliced and fried. I think it's fried on each side like
Spam?
Yeah.
And you buy it at the grocery store. You can get it at Kroger before you leave town.
I have got to come and try it. I read about it and my mouth watered and it is not in the book. It was one of the few that didn't make it in and I love reading about it and I can't wait to taste it. And where I live in Pennsylvania now and come out and I'll take you out for some scrapple and we'll have to compare them side by side.
All right. Zach, thanks a lot for that call. Let's see. Donald in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Donald.
Hello. Hey, I was going to say my quintessential dinner would be spaghetti, meatballs, breadsticks and a salad. Everywhere I've traveled in America, everybody has that.
I remember when I was in college, I could get that for $1.99, and it got me through my junior year in college. Gabrielle Engholtz?
Yeah, when I was a kid, my mom made spaghetti and meatballs, just like you described, breadsticks and a salad, probably three nights a week. And for my birthday, us kids were allowed to pick what we wanted. We would just beg for exactly that, even though we had probably eaten it the night before, too. So, yes, perfect example of something that has become quintessential, that's sort of the food of immigrants and also kind of a creation here, like so many, like chop suey and mm-hmm. so many things that don't exist in the country that in our imagination we think of them. I mean, yeah, obviously you can get spaghetti and meatballs in Italy, but we've got our own incarnation. And as we come up on Thanksgiving, I think it's such a perfect time to think about how that menu reflects American identity and our memories, the foods that grow here, the wild and local harvests, and the foods that we've all brought here for centuries.
Thank you for that call. Now, Jeff in Lancaster, you're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ann. How you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Hey, Jeff.
So, how you doing?
Good.
So, a few things now, since I've been waiting. on the point of Geta. There's actually a place in Columbus you can get it besides Kroger that I highly recommend. It's Thurn's Meat Market down off of Greenlawn.
Uh-huh.
They are an old German butcher shop. If you ever come to town, Gabrielle, you absolutely have to go there. The smells
Great.
Emanating from that place week round are mm-hmm. just intoxicating.
Great.
But my father, also being from German heritage myself, makes a pork tenderloin. He does it in the crock pot, but it's a pork tenderloin with sauerkraut. And because we're in Ohio, of course, you have to add the applesauce in with it as well, with a little bit of brown sugar over the top. And you just put it on low for 10 hours and leave it. And it breaks apart almost like a pulled pork. And it is just one of those things from my childhood that anytime I taste it, it just immediately takes me back.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point of fast food, my final point here, to the point of fast food, I don't dignify that with the title of food. I would call it marginal sustenance.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I haven't partaken in it, but
I'm going to go make that pork tenderloin, sauerkraut, applesauce, I think for dinner tonight. My mouth is watering.
Exactly.
I'm really hearing you talk about it.
Yeah. It's crock pot season. One more call. Iris in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I was wondering about something called sugar cream pie. When I used to visit my grandparents in southeastern Ohio, they would get it from a little restaurant there. And not recently, but I used to see it like in supermarkets, and it was made by a company, I think, in Indiana. And I've heard it was native to like Ohio and Indiana, so I was wondering about that.
There is a Hoosier cream pie that is, I think, the state pie of Indiana. So it sounds like that's the same one that you're thinking of, yes?
Mm-hmm. We haven't even talked about the hamburger or the pie.
I know. That, well, you know, when I turned the book in, I literally didn't have a hamburger in it. I mean, I literally turned in 850 recipes, and my editor wrote me a one-line email that said, "We need a burger."
Yeah.
It was intentional. I was trying to say American food is, you know, I think I was trying to paraphrase Shakespeare and say, "I come to bury the burger, not to praise him." But she was right. You know, we do need a burger and a Caesar salad, and they're in the book. But the caller's question, we just had so much fun with the pies. I think we have over 50 pies, and they're unusual, and they're regional and special. I mean, even the apple pie alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about apple pie being as American as apple pie, even though, of course, apples are native to Afghanistan and, you know, again, see foods of immigrants, although, you know, took an indirect route. But apple pie in New England, of course, people spike it with cheddar cheese, and down in the Southwest with hatch green chilies. So you could do your Thanksgiving pie sideboard with all just different riffs on on apple pie, although I'd love to have that Hoosier cream pie on the sideboard, too.
Exactly. That sounds delish. Gabrielle Langholtz, the hour just flew by. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Gabrielle Langholtz is author of a new book. It's called America, the Cookbook. She's also former editor of Edible Manhattan and Edible Brooklyn. Thanks for to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lynette, All Sides interns Kyle McKinnon, Courtney Gilbert, Dan Posniak, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.